and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and our topic today is downtown Kenosha. And so my guest today is, of course, Christopher Nauman. Christopher Nauman is intimately involved with downtown Kenosha. He's the executive director of Downtown Kenosha, Inc. Welcome, Christopher.
Good morning, Len. Thank you for having me.
Well, we had a very interesting meeting earlier this week that was widely reported in the Kenosha News about something called a Kenosha Creative Space. Mm-hmm. And there was some big front page coverage of it. I think it was Wednesday morning. And then there was a commentary written by an editorial page editor, Steve Lund. The Kenosha News is certainly behind this. And you had a big crowd at the Kenosha Public Museum to hear about it. I think the question now is, what's next and how do you gauge the reaction to the creative space? And for those who aren't up to date, it's about the old Kresge dime store where I used to luxuriate as a kid when Ma would give me a buck to go downtown and I could take the bus and do a movie and then buy myself a little trinket at Kresge afterwards. I spent many hours in that store. Chris, tell us a little bit about the project and how it's going now.
Well, thank you for having me in today and talking about all the projects going on in downtown Kenosha. This project, the Kenosha Creative Space, is one that's recently gotten a lot of traction to it. It's a pursuit of Francisco Loyola and Expose Kenosha with the Kenosha Art Association. It is looking to repurpose the old Kresge department store right along 6th Avenue in our historic downtown Kenosha to repurpose that property into essentially an incubator for the arts. So there's really cool vision behind this that will include offices for nonprofits, a co-working space, a creative makers laboratory or space, some tenant space, a real gathering place for activity and creatives.
And my understanding is that we're in the very much in the active design stage now, and we haven't cast a floor plan quite in stone yet, but you're working towards a vision that you're sharing with the community, and you're pretty close to a final product.
Yeah, absolutely. So from the Downtown Kenosha Incorporated perspective, we're really kind of helping on the consultation side of this project. My expertise personally is on the design, so I've been able to kind of help out develop some of the floor plan components and really, from a conceptual standpoint, offer direction to the architect and the developers behind this. So where we're at right now essentially is a grant has been issued or tentatively issued by the city dependent on some matching funds. So they are in a mode of fundraising. So to generate excitement for fundraising, obviously having graphics and designs and schematic development completed really helps in that cause. So that's what's been happening most recently, and we are now showing those off to the public and getting the energy behind the concept such that this fundraising can take place and we can bring the project to fruition.
Now, when I look at you, when I first met you, I noticed a whole string of initials after your name. And even though I'm a professional journalist and try to know what most of these initials mean, you sent me to my dictionary. So, but you mentioned design, Chris, mm-hmm. Christopher, and you are certainly have credentials in that area. I want to share with my audience why we're interested in your opinions about design, because you have such great experience and credentials. The first initial after your name is AIA. What's that?
American Institute of Architects.
That one I knew. Then the ALA, that sent me to the dictionary.
Mm-hmm. That is the Association of Licensed Architects.
Okay, so that means you're licensed to architect.
Absolutely.
What is that?
So as an architect, I am certified. It's called NCARB, the National Council of Accreditation Boards for Architecture.
And that's the last set of initials after your name.
That is. So
NCARB. I thought it was some new diet fad.
That just simply means I'm accredited and I am certified to practice architecture. So then I am licensed. Technically, I'm licensed in the state of Minnesota currently. That's where I had practiced professionally.
I see.
But that certification carries with you professionally. So the AIA and the ALA are those professional organizations associated with architects.
Okay. Well, it's better to be certified than certifiable, I'm sure. Yeah. Okay. Now, let's go back to that Kresge building, mm-hmm. because it actually represents a school of architecture, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
We locals, I've been back now for 16 years, but I was born and raised mm-hmm. here. We just think of that as a box and don't really much love it, frankly. But I've come to love it as I've gotten older and as I've traveled around the country, and I've begun to realize that it is a sort of an archetype of a type of architecture.
It is. It is an amazing example of mid-century modern design that came out of the 1950s and 60s. And really, that's what's kind of very exciting about this project is it kind of brings this this great historic structure back and adds a little postmodernism push to it with this kind of, if you've seen the renderings, it's kind of this blue corner that we're trying to accentuate. So it kind of takes this beautiful postmodern expression of this mid-century modern treasure that we have and brings it alive. And in Kenosha, there's just a few of these buildings that are designed so, I guess, clearly to the archetype of mid-century modern. This is one of them, so it's certainly one we want to preserve.
And in a great showplace of our downtown, as we preserve a lot of other kinds of architecture downtown. It's great to have a community and a downtown that has a variety of architectural forms. I know I go to other places to see that, and I'm sure people will and do come here.
It speaks to our character of our place and our sense of design, our sense of tying ourselves to a community. Those unique architecture typologies create the environment that defines Kenosha and who we are.
Now, people in your downtown redevelopment profession and in economic development often talk, Christopher, about building social and cultural capital, and that has been important for economic development. Now, social and cultural capital is a rather academic term. Do you want to tell us what, in a practical way, what we mean by that?
Sure. So when you're doing economic development itself is a very tangible and measurable thing. You have statistics and dollars you can track. Things like cultural capital and social capital, they're a little more difficult. They're a little more intangible. The words quality of life often come up when people are talking about these things. Cultural capital is really the things along your cultural institutions. You think of things like the museums. You think of things like gathering places, events. Those are things that build your local culture. And certainly they add value to a particular place that because they're going to be unique from city to city. So those things really give us a sense of identity. Social capital is a little different in that it's really about interactivity. So social capital is about, for instance, having a place to gather with friends, and we call it accidental collisions in development, where you have people that don't necessarily know each other come together, they collide, they interact, and new ideas form from that. So that in that concept, you create a bit of an economic value because you may have someone who sells insurance talk to an artist, and suddenly they're working together to collaborate to create a new product or a new innovation in the economy. So those three things, the actual economic development work, which is the incentives, the kind of the money, the nuts and bolts, the cultural capital, which is really the attractiveness of the amenities that we have in a community, and then the social capital, which is the people, the engine of the people.
So you have a rather holistic view of all of this. You're not looking for one magic bullet. You're looking at a multiplicity of approaches to bring more vitality and life to downtown and, by implication, to our whole community. I think that's very interesting. And when you talk about the social capital, Christopher, I'm reminded of the very hackneyed phrase, networking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because that's what it allows for casual networking. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, as I've traveled around in the last few years, I've seen more and more of these spaces outside of our area. And there's even a movement among the universities and colleges now to create those spaces on campuses because we're beginning to understand that it's so important to have connections and to have a social culture where people are interacting with each other in productive ways.
Absolutely. If you really look at trending, what I find so fascinating is the more technology we have and the more our growth patterns are more sprawl orientated, you find silos starting to occur. So we might be communicating with people, but we're not interacting face-to-face. The technology kind of keeps us from doing that or makes it convenient so we don't have to meet face-to-face. Or if we live in a suburban community, per se, we go to our house, we close the garage door, we don't really interact with our neighbors much. Or we go to the store. It's a lot of individual back and forth. So ships passing in the night, so to speak. The great thing about urban environments, tighter, more dense environments, these collective spaces that kind of open up social opportunities, is it forces us to stop the texting on the phone and have a conversation with someone. You rub elbows, you shake hands, kind of getting back to the old school of networking, as you might call it. Today we call it accidental collisions. It's just another name for the same type of interaction.
And the more we interact with each other, those of us of different cultures, different faith traditions, different academic traditions, different tradesmen's conditions, and professional experiences, we learn so much from each other. And that diversity, it strengthens our community. So I see all sorts of really good sort of byproducts of this that a lot of my colleagues in other disciplines would approve of.
Absolutely, and that's really the building blocks for a lot of downtown development, in particular the Main Street program that we stick to in Kenosha. This idea that taking a holistic approach, looking at things beyond bricks and mortar, although bricks and mortar is key and investment is key and dollars are key, it's the supportive capacity of that environment and the stimulation that you bring to the environment to create an exciting place, a vital place, a vibrant place for your economy to evolve. That's really what we're doing.
I'd like to take a little detour for just a second, Christopher, since we are talking about downtown. There was, you might recall, a lot of hoopla about a streetcar going through downtown not so long ago. What's kind of the status of the fallout after that? What kind of residual feelings do people have in the downtown businesses? What do you sense in terms of the public mood and in the business downtown mood they're looking for next? Because we know that transportation is an issue in and out of downtown, and parking will be once we're successful.
No pun intended, but it's the third rail of local politics, so to speak. So maybe to set this conversation into context, the streetcar was defined in a 2012 downtown strategic development plan in terms of a priority to help reinvigorate the downtown, revitalize the downtown. So a streetcar expansion was formed, building off of what was done about 12 or 15 years ago in the downtown with the current streetcar loop, which is really a central part of our brand and our identity and has been a very popular destination to bring in visitors and tourists and image and brand.
That's right.
So this expansion was conceptualized in somewhat reaction to this strategic plan where a planning process was implemented with a lot of citizen participation and a lot of buy-in from different partners to say, yes, this is going to be something we're going to get behind and start developing. There's 24 initiatives. The streetcar is just one of 24. So
you're not
forward.
Freaked out about that?
Not yet. and I'll explain why. So you know, let's fast forward. So I got here about a year ago. The streetcar expansion had been in process in terms of I guess the nuts and bolts of getting it to happen, and it was in its financing component, and it received some debate back and forth in the community. There's clearly a component in the community that think that that's not necessarily the best use of resources. And it went back and forth, and it got pretty fierce because there, you know, things can be politicized easily in the current culture.
It produced more heat, not much light, but it produced more heat than most things lately in my recollection.
Exactly. So from that standpoint, you know, it was a little illuminating for me, new to the community, kind of learning the different factions involved. The concept was to expand the streetcar north and south in about a two-mile loop connecting to the existing two-mile loop in a way that would be, in my opinion, a little more transit-based because you'd be moving more population from areas like the hospital zone to the south to neighborhoods to the north. So it was just another layer to the fabric, so to speak, from mm-hmm. my standpoint as a planner and looking at things as from a design and an impact standpoint. However, you know, there were opponents to it, and it did create some controversy. You know, and we're all familiar with what those arguments were and the political components behind them. So, you know, it didn't happen. It wasn't funded. It was essentially delayed indefinitely.
Well, as I understand it, it was essentially killed by We Energies refusing to make reasonable – what the city considered reasonable concessions in terms of the cost of relocating utilities. Mm-hmm. And that's another whole story which I don't want to get into this
another
morning.
Part of the process that kind of interfered.
So now what? Now what?
Well, so I mean, that's one project of 24. So from
how
my standpoint –
how do the businesses feel about that? Are they happy now downtown? Are they still concerned about transportation and parking?
Well, transportation is a big deal. And parking is another your apples and oranges kind of conversation, which we're going to get to parking. So transportation alone, yes, there is a concern, particularly dealing with I guess you want to call it there are workers downtown who can't necessarily afford to live downtown, and how do they get into their working opportunities, or how do we and congestion comes in terms of idea of moving people around to these venues. If we want to densify the downtown and increase development, we need to improve the transit conditions. Now, we do have a transit station in the downtown. It's tied to the streetcars, but it also is a center point for the bus system. And, you know, it works pretty well, but there are some concerns about it. And I believe, like, how do we connect to the universities? That's one big question. You know, we've got three great institutions of higher learning in the area, and how do we connect to them?
Which is a good idea because not every student has cars. But it's probably not a huge problem because they're all commuter campuses except for a sizable portion at Carthage and Parkside. So people need to remember that they're not totally 100% commuter campuses. There are a lot of people, a lot of young people up there who have cars who want to go into town and do something.
Well, it's not just doing
They don't have cars.
There's an employee base there that we have to consider, too. So service industry, in particular restaurant workers, people working in these industries are typically students or young adults, and they may be living in near campus because they're taking part-time courses, or maybe they're full-time students and they're looking for part-time work. Either way, that public transit component is key. We also have an aging population here in Kenosha.
Don't remind me.
Public transit is going to be key to that demographic
as it continues
to age. So we're really making sure that our downtown is accessible for those populations is key. Not everyone drives. I know people who live in Kenosha who are professionals, and they commute via the Metro Rail station. I don't know if they own a car. I see them walking everywhere. I believe they do most of their errands walking. They love that pedestrian component as well. So those are all components of the downtown that we do have to consider when we think about transit.
Well, I'm happy to hear, if I understand you correctly, that the business community downtown understands that the transportation problem isn't solved by nixing the streetcar.
Well, there are, you know, you're going to find opinions on every side of the question. I think those who are, I think where the optimism might come in right now is the fact that there's this grant on the table, and we don't want to see that grant go away. I
mean, we're trying to repurpose the streetcar money for expanded bus routes to mitigate pollution.
Exactly. And in any way you cut it, if it improves transit into the downtown via buses or streetcar, it's going to be a net gain for downtown. So for me, if it's a well-executed grant and it's a good system, let's invest in it. Now, the streetcar did add some other levels of value to real estate and to development opportunities.
Yes.
That's where buses just aren't as effective. And you can go to a million studies and people can argue until they're red in the face. The truth is, when you invest in the infrastructure behind rail, investment will and does follow.
There are many documented studies of that. This is a pipe dream.
That's just reality. But given the fact that if I have to be given a choice and I have to be say, do we let this transportation grant go or do we repurpose it? I'm okay repurposing it because, again, if it enhances the net gain of downtown for access, that's really the point.
My guest this morning on Community Matters, and we're talking, of course, about downtown Kenosha, is Christopher Nauman. Christopher is the executive director of Downtown Kenosha, Inc. He's been with us for about a year. Mm-hmm. And, Christopher, I was very impressed the other night. You were rattling off the names of all the buildings up one of the streets that I used to shop at all those stores when I was a kid. And you're a fast learner. You got all those names down pretty fast. But I think that this point you make about the density of downtown and this transportation issue is something that we really do have to keep a focus on. I remember the days when the Kenosha National Bank building, our little skyscraper, mm-hmm. was fully occupied. Mm-hmm. And those people poured out, and they were at the lunch counters at Kresge's and Woolworth's and other little lunch counters around downtown. Mm-hmm. And we had a very busy downtown. And if we get that density again, we need transportation because that's how we managed it back then. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think people would be surprised the level of activity that we have actually today. Most of our buildings are actually performing pretty well. I call them my troubled children. We have about 7 buildings in a concentrated area around the 58th Street corridor that are these older department stores. And just by the nature of their scale and this type of construction they have, they've been difficult to reposition over the years for adaptive reuse. Now, does that mean that there's no value to them? You need to discard them? No. My argument as a preservationist and an economic development professional is these buildings have intricate value because of the social capital and the cultural capital attached to them, the nostalgia.
These are the kind of buildings I go to visit when I travel elsewhere.
Exactly. So there are uses for these buildings. Now, the challenge is marrying the right use to the building and the timing and financing, and that will come over time. In fact, the creative space is just one alternative that we're seeing come into the Kresge space. These projects don't happen overnight. I think people sometimes lose perspective and patience.
Well, some of these buildings have been occupied for a very, very unoccupied for a very, very, very long time, Christopher.
Absolutely.
And I lost hope on some of them quite some time ago. But I'm happy to see what's happening now. Mm-hmm. So what's different now?
Well, I think –
We've had absentee landlords who didn't give a rat's behind about us or downtown, mm-hmm. and the city, for whatever reasons, couldn't or wouldn't enforce codes, mm-hmm. and now that's changing. Is that what's happening?
Yes. I mean, well, we're seeing the
– What's going to be different? Why is it different is what the cynic wants to know.
I think what's happening is there are some intergenerational changes happening with millennials – really bringing a lot more appreciation to urban life. I think you also have investment pressures from baby boomers retiring, looking for a little different, unique experience. I think there's some forces in the demographic that are changing that are and it's happened in other communities. Kenosha is a little behind the curve looking at urban development. Now, that's not to say that it's not going to work here. It is absolutely going to work here. We've had a little bit of a glut with these absentee landlords, but that's shifting because the nature of the economy, they went into investments when real estate was valued perhaps a little too high. The market got a little too hot. The Great Recession came through.
And nobody bought anything.
Well, that's right. But the bottom fell out. So the motivators there to improve the real estate haven't been there. Now they're coming back. Rents are starting to come up. So that makes the function and the utility of the building more valuable. And that now enhances potential investors to come in, starting to move ownership around, which is happening. It's on a very slow and deliberate pace right now. But as these buildings will fill and as we activate the spaces, you're going to see more value, which is going to then generate more development. You look at the Heritage House as an example. That's another key property in downtown that's on the cusp of a new life, which, you know, a very exciting prospects for a boutique hotel at that location. And then you look to the other side of 58th, and you've got the Fifth Avenue Lofts, which are going to be 100 new apartments, basically bridging the gap between the marina area and the downtown. But those three developments with the creative space are starting to create this hopscotch effect of investment, which now you're going to see the us filling in the dots, so to speak, with investment opportunities and interest.
Well, so that's an exciting prospect, Christopher. The vacancy issue, mm-hmm. though, the perception you have when you drive around downtown is that there are a lot of vacant storefronts.
Mm-hmm.
And to be perfectly frank, I'm not impressed with the job we've done of making them look pretty when they're empty.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me darn angry, actually, because I go to other cities and I see that they dress up the windows. And sometimes we get them dressed up, and the Art Association does a great job in certain spaces,
mm-hmm.
and I
Absolutely.
Really appreciate what they do. It's not that I don't appreciate what is being done, but why in creation can't we get those storefronts looking decent and put a bouquet or a mural or something, and then we got enough artists in this community? Is it the landlords that just don't give a darn?
Well, let's start out with the vacancy issue itself. So I heard that a lot when I came into the town, as we have a vacancy problem, and I was observing something different in my experience. So this summer, engaged a volunteer intern that we had come into the office, Nathan Davis, and I'm sure he listens, and he's going to be very happy that we talk about his work. He put together a study where we actually inventoried 152 buildings in the downtown bid district. So there's a boundary, and we
business
had a
business improvement district.
Exactly,
BID,
uh-huh. Mostly commercial-based properties. And we kind of started looking, and we looked at, okay, is the building vacant? If so, you know, what are the uses of the building essentially? Like, who's there? If there are vacancies, we tried to chronicle, we tried to document them, and then we kind of just, in the end, we went through the data set that we created over the summer. We found some very interesting statistics.
Oh, okay. So you're going to move me now from the perception of when I drive through downtown
to the reality.
What's really going on?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is after we know the numbers, we can start defining why it feels this way. So here's what's interesting.
Okay.
So
I'm game.
We have 20% vacancy in the bid overall.
Isn't that considered high?
It is an aggressive number. However, remember I talked about 58th Street with my seven troubled children, those
mm-hmm.
bigger department store typologies, just in that little three-block concentration. You take them out of the mix. Just let's say they're not part of the statistical count.
Okay, because they are. That's kind of a special case.
Exactly.
Gardens, Montgomery,
and
Lords,
it's concentrated
Kenny's.
In one zone.
Yes.
The rest of downtown now, vacancy number is 9.5%.
Wow.
Which, when you think about a commercial downtown, usually 6 to 7% is a very viable, healthy downtown.
You consider that normal?
Exactly. So 9% isn't that bad.
Within the range,
it's close. I mean, it is not like this. Oh my God, everything is vacant and empty. Number that's what people are perceiving.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, so now we have to understand why do people feel like everything's vacant? Because not everyone drives down 58th Street, yet they still have this perception. So I think part of the question is, what about the existing tenants, and who are they, and why do things the storefronts not feel active? Well, another number that surprised me out of the study was 20% of our use, 25% actually, was residential uses. So in all those commercial properties, a lot of them have secondary apartments upstairs. And you don't always know that. You think there are offices that might be empty, but those during the daytime, those people aren't there. They're there in the evenings.
You see them coming and going at night.
Exactly.
If you're down there to eat or recreate.
But your daytime activation is very light because right. those are people with jobs. So, again, that's part of the perception. So then you start thinking about, okay, there's a lot of service industry too. There's not a lot of traditional retail. It's about 50-50. So now you're starting to think, okay, who are using those spaces? Well, professional offices, they might be set back in the building. They might not have an active storefront. Or there might be people that are not using a storefront as a storefront. We have a couple of churches or a couple of institutional uses where they cover up their storefronts. And it looks like it's dead vacant space, but there is a rent-paying tenant in there, and they are active with the space, but you don't feel that on the street.
But it creates a horrible impression when people drive down the street,
does.
I think.
So the challenge is less about filling vacancy, unless you're talking our big trouble children, right?
Yeah.
And more about how do we activate those storefronts. So how do we – maybe lighting is different in the evening. How do we light things up so things feel warmer on the inside, more pleasant on the outside? Because we have some empty parking lots that aren't lit well. It starts feeling a little dank. It starts feeling a little dangerous, even though it's not. It's the perception that's key. So by, you know, introducing some new architectural lighting, some new streetscaping, some very basic things, and then encouraging building owners or tenants to open up the drape, put on some lights, put in some new signage. Those are going to be things that are going to radically change perceptions of our downtown.
Yeah, do you all know how awful it looks when I drive down the street and past your building and it's an empty storefront? Do something, folks.
Well, and these landlords who, yeah, I hear this story a lot, I'm struggling to lease my space. Well, anyone who knows cars, if you're going to sell a car, if you own a car, do you take it through the mud and then show it off?
No.
You wash the car, you wax the car, you detail the car, then you try to sell the car. So when these people have properties, when some of these landlords have properties and the properties aren't looking the best, you know, they're not going to rent that high and they're not going to get a lot of tenant interest. So
called curb appeal when I try to sell a house.
Absolutely. So again, part of our challenge is convincing the landlords and these owners that the rent, supportive rent capacity potential is there, but they need to lift their buildings to a certain level to achieve that. And that's the challenge.
Well, you have an easy job ahead of you, don't you, Christopher? You have hardly anything to do. Let me move on to another topic. This is very interesting to talk about, but I'm wondering about some of the other properties, and now we kind of set aside the big boxes on 58th Street, but they're not that big, but they're big enough. What about the Orpheum and the Kenosha Theater?
Yes.
Now, the Kenosha Theater, I'm a little prejudiced in favor of that. I would love to see that happen. I remember the Kenosha Theater. It's one of the grandest theaters I've ever been in anywhere. Mm-hmm. It was, as I recall, the story is that we got a theater much better than we deserved because of a vice president at the movie chain who wanted to make sure his hometown got a good theater. I don't know if that's apocryphal or not. Now, I can understand why that wasn't a first priority. That's a way too big a project to make a first priority to renovate a downtown or rejuvenate a downtown. But I go to the Genesee regularly. I go to the Genesee. The place is sold out night after night. And why couldn't the Kenosha Theater be like that down like what we have in Waukegan?
Well, there's a few things to approach. First of all, the potential is there. The question is, how do you bridge to the potential? And that's really where we're getting hung up because – and this is what's fascinating about Kenosha. Kenosha supported these beautiful theaters turn of the century because, you know, you got the Rhodey Opera House. You've got the Orpheum. You've got the Fox. And then there were a lot of smaller theater venues throughout. There was
the Vogue. I passed by the Vogue regularly. I used to go to the Vogue when I was a kid.
And to have that many seats, theater seats available in a community that was the size that Kenosha was at the turn of the century, it's remarkable that any of them were viable. So as we're looking now, I mean, we've had population growth. We've had all this stuff. It would make sense that, yeah, we should be able to support those theaters, but the culture is different, and the theatrical audience is different, and what theaters need to be is different to be competitive. So we're sitting right now on three major theaters in the downtown, and the Orpheum, which is actually – I'm sorry, the Rhodey – is under use right now by the river or by the Lakeside Players.
Yes.
They conduct they have a theater group there, a troupe, and they're doing shows, which is great, and they've maintained the building. It's really beautiful. So that's one theater that is in good shape and it's being reused.
There've been some mechanical problems that we keep having to fix, but it's working.
It's a challenged facility. Yeah. It's an older facility, but you know, it's holding its own.
Yeah. They're doing a great job.
Exactly.
We're proud of them.
And we want to support them and we want to make sure that they get the support for the building in particular.
That's right.
It's a gorgeous facility.
We need to preserve that building.
So that's one that's active right now. Now, the two major ones that are still standing but inactive are the Orpheum, which is part of some other commercial property that's had some success, and the old Kenosha Theater. So the Orpheum itself is an interesting story.
Is there still a theater back there?
There is. It's a beautiful theater volume. At one point, it was converted into a movie house. And then it was going to be modernized, but somewhere along the line during that process, developer ran out of money. You know, the property exchanged hands, so it's kind of in this weird state of repositioning in the back of the theater.
I've been in the Kenosha, but I've never been in the Orpheum.
Yeah, and you know, it's a very interesting building. But what's helped the Orpheum stay viable is it's attached to some commercial property within it, and that's been leased out, so it had its cash flowed. It's preserved the building. It's kept it from really falling into disrepair, which is great. But that's not to say there's not a tremendous opportunity with that building. But, you know, it's going to require a lot of work to bring it up to that level of modernization. And then the question is, what type of venue is it going to be? Is it going to be a movie house? Will it be for live performance? What's key is we continue to protect that building until the market can support it with one of those uses, and we find an investor, an entrepreneur, or an organization willing to come in to do that work. A very similar project in scope and scale is the Meyer Theater up in the Green Bay area. Very similar, and that's kind of where I come from, so I'm familiar with it, and it was a very similar story. It was a theater that was it was like a vaudeville performance theater that was converted into a movie house, very similarly to the way the Orpheum was converted. And about a dozen years ago, a nonprofit group came in after it had been vacant for years, restored it back to its grandness as a performance venue. And today it's a very successful kind of a small, intimate, like 500-seat performance venue, and they're bringing in national comedians and performance artists. But it's taken a long road to get there from where the conception happened to the execution. The Orpheum's in a very similar position. If we can find that right group and an investor to come in to take it on.
Michael Cudahy took over the couple of theaters in downtown Milwaukee because no one else could figure out how to run them. He hired the right people.
Yep.
And the Riverside and the Pabst mm-hmm. are doing great. Every time I go there, every seat is full. And
absolutely.
It's a mixture of events. And it's hard to imagine that not happening. Now, the Kenosha Theater, I know, is a much more difficult problem.
Yes.
And it would require several millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions.
But see, what the nice thing about the Kenosha Theater is there's a nonprofit entity that owns it currently and it's keeping the structure maintained.
I wasn't clear if the ownership of that building was now nonprofit or not.
Because
that would be a key impediment if it weren't, I think.
It's a nonprofit.
In terms of preservation right now.
There are some apartments attached to that building mm-hmm. that are occupied. So it generates just enough rent to pay its taxes and to pay the major maintenance issues. But obviously that level of cash flow isn't enough to bring the property back. Now, I've toured the property. It's gorgeous. It's got these beautiful curving staircases. It's got these great volumes and these great opportunities.
And that floor, that poured concrete floor, mm-hmm. When I went in there a few years ago with my dad, I couldn't find a crack in the floor.
No, it's very structurally sound.
I was stunned. I said, I wish my basement looked like this.
And people will, what will happen is quite often in the rumor mill, someone will get into a vacant building, take some pictures of worse conditions, and then publish them as, oh, this building needs to come down, or what a shame. If you're in the building industry, construction industry, you find that stuff all the time. It's very typical. So the damages to the building because of water issues before the roof was fixed damaged most of the plaster.
Oh, the horsehair plaster.
Yeah.
All
this decorative stuff is taken down, and that's sad, and
it looks
horrible.
But it can be recreated. I understand the molds still exist.
Exactly. And the structure is key, and the structure is solid.
I don't think you could knock that building down easily. I remember when they did knock down the high school annex, mm-hmm. and that building should never have been knocked down, in my opinion. The contractor had to bring in heavier equipment to knock it down because it was so much sounder than people thought. All you had to do was gut the inside of the building, and you'd had a structure that would last 1,000 years.
And that's the nature of these older buildings. They're very heavily constructed, which, you know, when you really think about what it takes to bring them down versus the cost of doing something else, it always makes more sense to try to repurpose these. Now, the theater has a very passionate group behind it that do vision this space as a new performance venue in the future, and they have a plan and a goal. It's going to take more than just having a plan and a goal. And even if they achieve fundraising, we need to build the supportive capacity around it in the neighborhood for parking, for apartments, for other things to develop that market so their audience is there. You can't just throw money at one project. The magic bullet we mentioned earlier, it just doesn't work. So even if you had, let's say an investor came in with $30 million and they took care of the theater and it was up and running, doesn't mean it's going to be successful. You need to build up that audience around it. You need to build up the shows and all that support of real estate. So hopefully over time, as we're doing these increment steps, the environment will be produced that will support these cedars and bring them back. And that's certainly our goal.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that's in the mix, because those are important opportunities for us in the longer term. And we certainly do need to walk and take the precursor steps of density and traffic flow. And that reminds me of one of my pet peeves, and this came up in the study that we commissioned, which was a very good study that was commissioned by the consortium of groups about downtown Kenosha, and that is signage into the city.
Mm-hmm.
We have Simmons Island, one of the nicest beaches around anywhere. We have all that is downtown. There is some decent signage to the colleges now, but out on I-94 it should be better. There's really no signage on I-94 directing you to a cultural district in Kenosha. Mm-hmm. I used to be a trustee of the library, and I'm on the Library Foundation board, full disclosure. We think that treasure ought to be marketed as a cultural treasure and attract visitors. It's a Burnham building. It's one of the few around. It's a magnificent building. It's been beautifully preserved by the city. God bless the city for putting the money into it, just like it has with the courthouse and with Reuther High School, the old Bradford I attended. Mm-hmm. But as you come in on 142, 32 from the north or the south, 50. There's not much in the way of signage directing you to a cultural district. Is that because we just can't get it together, or people think it's too soon to direct people downtown? That seemed to me to be the first step and the easiest thing to do, but I have seen like 3 signs go up so far, and that's it.
What we have on the strategic development plan is second priority is wayfinding and signing. And wayfinding and signage. I need to learn to talk. But that is absolutely key. So we have a major freeway, 94, that connects 2 major markets and has huge traffic counts.
Couldn't be bigger.
So you've got massive population moves back and forth along there. And our downtown is removed from that. It is 6 miles due east and on the waterfront. So that's a bit of a mixed blessing, believe it or not, because even though we're missing that heavy traffic, it has allowed us to be a little bit more protective and isolationist dealing with historic properties and stuff. You don't feel that immediate development pressure that might take down those properties. Unfortunately, the bad part is how now we need some of that traffic to develop economic activity and interest in our downtown to take advantage of the cultural capital we have. Correct?
And we have the right layout of streets. It's not like Racine. We're trying to get to downtown from the highway is a real pain in the.
We've got 2 major ways to get downtown. 3, I guess, if you consider, K?
K, 60th Street,
yep, 60th.
52nd Street.
158,
Of course, Highway 50, 75th Street, which is going to be and continue to be the main arterial as we widen that road.
Well, exactly. So you do have these kind of straight shots towards the downtown in terms of directions. It's very simple. Get off the highway straight. Where there are some challenges is the condition of the road, and 158 was just resurfaced, so that helps.
That's great.
So the condition of the experience, the procession, so to speak, from the highway to downtown, what is it you experience? Now, part of it is signage, which we're lacking, directionals, and, you know, feature signing, you know, what is downtown?
Highway 50 is so easy now that they redirected Highway 50 down Roosevelt Road, which isn't new. Mm-hmm. It takes you
right
to the heart of downtown almost, right into the hospital.
But if you aren't a local person who understands that, let's say you're visiting the Recplex with people for a softball
tournament. You get to Sheridan Road and Roosevelt Road, and you don't know what to do.
You see a cool intersection. You see edges of uptown. You see some things going on, but you don't know where you need to go.
That's right.
So part of that is driving that traffic. But what we also have are some gateway elements, too, that we could enhance. So really when you get into the downtown, you've got the train trestles, all the different places you cross under the train tracks. That's a gateway element. So featuring that with some highlight would also help draw people in. The advantage we have, too, with geography is if you're up on the hill by Green Bay Road on 158 and you're driving towards downtown, if it's a sunny day, the sun reflects off the lake and creates a beacon that draws you to it. So
In
a way that we have some geographic advantage here, people know something's happening by the water.
I like your talk about defining the downtown area visually in some way in terms of gateways to the downtown itself. If I knew what that meant and how to do it, I would tell you. But I have a feeling you have some ideas.
Well, and that's part of this process that we'd go through in terms of defining the opportunities and what does it take. So the wayfinding signage is key. And some of that has already been produced by the city. We're waiting for it to be installed. That would help a lot. But once you even get into downtown, where are the museums? You know, how to find them? Because, again, if you're not local, you might not know where they are.
We've got a couple of signs, but there could be more. Yeah.
Where can we park? We've got parking lots, but because they're not necessarily signed consistently, That you don't know if you're allowed to park there or not. You don't know who owns them. Can I park there? These are the things that the signage would help with, and it, particularly if it's a consistent signage package. So I guess those things we've been working with the city on, and some things have been progressed but not completed, and that's the state of where we're at with signage.
I suppose with signage, you've got if it goes on state routes, there are approvals and rules and regulations. So maybe I'm just a little too impatient.
Well, a little bit of that, a little bit of just getting the project done. The Main Street program exists because we like to use volunteers to roll up our sleeves and to do things, and we're ready to put in signs if we have to.
Well, that brings me to a part of the program that I always think is the most important when I ask my guests, how can people who are listening get involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Main Street program is really based on stakeholder engagement. When you really look at the nuts and bolts of what differentiates us from other types of programs, Main Street programs are dependent on volunteers. So I am the only paid employee of Downtown Kenosha Incorporated, but we do tremendous amounts of work because we've got great volunteers in place that are in leadership positions with committees and project leadership, and they're the ones taking on all these challenges. So from our standpoint, we have four major committees, and they focus on different topics of economic development, including organization design, economic repositioning, and events and promotion. And those committees meet monthly, and they're the ones working with partners and bringing in different resources and brainstorming to create brochures and maps and walking tours and visioning for downtown. So they're the ones really that are driving the boat. And you can find all that information at our www.downtownkenosha.org website. And that'll tell you how you can get involved. We have a very active social media page, so you can see what's happening in the downtown. So we have a newsletter. We're constantly doing outreach. So if there's ever opportunities or interests that listeners here might have, they should come and talk to us, because if you're interested to work with downtown, we'll find work for you to do. There's a lot of challenges.
Well, that's great. And you have two good brochures out from www.downtownkenosha.org. There's a Downtown Kenosha business directory and maps, and some events are listed, some of the annual events are listed. And then you have a lovely walking historical tour, Central Downtown Edition, which I haven't seen this one yet. I don't know. Is this new?
That's pretty fresh off the presses. So that was a summer project for us, and we published it in the fall. We unveiled it at our State of the Downtown in October. And that's going to be a series of publications. We're looking at maybe one a year, looking at different edges of downtown from a historic perspective. And we're looking for some sponsorship there. We did a limited edition this year, but really we want to run these projects at a net zero to the organization. So to find some people to help offset printing costs and that sort of thing, that's what we're doing right now. But it's a great way to connect people to their history. When our volunteers were doing the research for our historic walking tour, we said, we don't want to just know the history of the building, when it was built, who built it, who owned it. We want to know the stories. What's the connective tissue that people today would have to that building or that area?
Connect it to the cultural and social history.
Because that's what makes it important.
That's right.
The minutia of the dates when it was built or who owned it, that will come. But if it's valued by people, guess what? Now we're going to protect it. Now we're going to be vested to say, guess what? My grandfather was married in that building. Or this is where so-and-so they did something significant here. This is how the building contributed to our culture. Those are the important things we need to know.
Well, that's great. My guest this morning on Community Matters has been Christopher Nauman. He's the executive director of Downtown Kenosha, Inc. You can learn more about Downtown Kenosha, Inc. on the web at www.downtownkenosha.org. I encourage you to get informed and get involved in this great endeavor. For Community Matters, this is Lena Aquinta. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org, click Talk, and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
'24/7 Jazz on WGTD HD2. Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more airing right now on HD2. For more information, go to WGTD.org or dial 564-3030.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, new alarm clocks of any kind are needed for Kenosha Unified students to help get the kids to school on time. Alarm clocks can be dropped off at the Educational Support Center, 3600 52nd Street, Kenosha, until December 30th.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Tool and die is a great career for people with manual dexterity, analytical skills, math aptitude, and a dedication to accuracy. Median wage about $50,000 annually. Apprenticeships available to Gateway graduates. Get started now at gtc.edu/programs.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort.